Time for This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis, and we remember the doink. Actually, the double doink, right, Anna?
Double. It was a double doink. Not a lot of reasons to celebrate Bears victories lately or big Bears happenings, but could be worse, Bob, and this reminds us all of that fact, because in 2019, this week, there was agony, just pain in the hearts of every Bears fan everywhere, when Cody Double Doink Parkey committed the act, that we just... He'll never live down, sadly. It was the end of the game, the field goal attempt, seconds to go, wild card game, no less, against the Philadelphia Eagles. His kick goes in. They keep Super Bowl dreams alive, however dim they may have been at the time. Still would have kept going, but instead, the season ended in a painful moment. Didn't go in. It hit the uprights, as we recall. It hit the crossbar. It was called the double doink by Chris Collinsworth. Here's the call. We pulled it for you.
And... It's impossible! And the Eagles run out into the field, but there's still 5 seconds. So they've got to get back. He does it again.
It will be Philadelphia.
Did this hit the upright and the crossbar?
Bottom line, it doesn't go through. Upright. It looks like it bounced off the crossbar as well.
Oh my goodness. The Bears season's going to end on a double doink.
I thought last week that the Bears were going to win because they had a doink and it actually was good. It went
through.
They
broke the curse, a lot of people said. The Bears fans took to social media, yay, the Cody Parkey curse, it's over. I don't know. I'm not sure. You know, for Cody Parkey's sake, I got to just correct, because the NFL did later look at it frame by frame and ruled that it was tipped. An Eagles defensive lineman got a hand on the ball. You couldn't see it really when you're watching the game live, but yes, it wasn't entirely Cody Parkey's fault.
All right. Glad we cleared his name here.
Clear that one up.
let's talk about the house on Mango Street.
Yeah, this is pretty incredible. Oh, I should mention Parkey was the 11th hit on the uprights of that season and the 6th, or the 11th miss and the 6th to hit the uprights. So that was the other reason people hated then Cody Parkey.
Yeah, right.
The House on Mango Street, though, Bob, amazing work, published just an iconic book in 1984, this week, 1984, by Mexican-American author Sandra Cisneros, debuted to critical acclaim, won a number of literary awards out of the gate, made the New York Times bestseller list, sold millions of copies, and translated now into 20 different languages. If you don't know The House on Mango Street, ask a younger member of your family. My daughter's reading it right now. Shortly after its debut in the mid-80s, it became required reading or suggested reading in a lot of school districts, a lot of schools across the country, including CPS. Just a coming-of-age book about a Mexican-American girl growing up working class in Humboldt Park. The author, Sandra Cisneros, said it wasn't quite autobiographical, but based on some of her life experiences and observations. And she's always asked, why Mango Street? Why'd you call it that? Is there a Mango Street in Chicago? And here's what she said.
There is no Mango Street in Chicago. There is a Mango Avenue. I didn't know that a Mango Avenue existed when I wrote House on Mango Street. The House on Mango Street is based on a real house in a real neighborhood, Humboldt Park, at a real address. But I picked up experiences and stories from other neighborhoods I lived in, other places I teached at, other communities I visited, and manipulated them and put them in this invented neighborhood called the House on Mango Street. In real life, the house was not on Mango Avenue or Mango Street. It was on Campbell Street. But I couldn't call it the house on Campbell Street because everybody would think of the soup. Right?
Yeah, and they made a little movie about mm-hmm. that a few years ago as well.
Yeah, it's really amazing to think of where she came from and what she was able to achieve with that book, and how it's just taken on life after life with so many students reading it across the country. Pretty incredible.
Mm-hmm. Now we move on to Chicago, and we are the bowling capital of the world, aren't we still?
Don't they say with Milwaukee or Wisconsin? I don't know. I think it's Chicago. Of course I do. But this week in 1901, Bob, Chicago was the buzz of the sporting world as the host of the first national bowling tournament, thousands of people came from across the country. They were watching it. You know, they were not watching on TV. There was no TV at that time, but they were trying to be part of it and applying to be a bowler in this because the sport was growing and there was an $80,000 prize purse. So pretty huge if you think in 1901 dollars that think that they were playing for that kind of money. You'll find this interesting, Bob. At the time, the top baseball players were, when they retired, were turning to the sport of bowling. And they were really the tops of the game. Cap Anson was one of the top two bowlers in the country at that time, a former Cubs star, first baseman, and left the sport, became a bowler. And, of course, they were called the White Stockings back then. But he was a big Chicago name, and he was competing against another top former baseball player, Frank Brill, who ended up winning. But bowling was just a huge, huge sport and growing. We pulled a clip from the Wayback Files back in the early days of television when they started to televise bowling. And here's a little bit from one of the Chicago bowling areas where they decided to broadcast it from.
The reason for it being drilled in this manner goes way back to the time when I used to use a two-fingered ball, and I smashed my hand in a car door accident, and I don't have the strength now. Mm-hmm. So I experimented with the type of a grip that would permit me to roll similar to a two-fingered ball. So I have this one finger drilled to fingertip depth, and the other one to semi-fingertip, with the fingertip overlapping the shorter finger. So that the two fingers serve as one, if you can see how they're mm-hmm. in the ball. Mm-hmm. One is almost over the top. And they come out and work together, so it's like one big finger in the ball. But I want to make one point of note here. It's not recommended for the beginner or the novice bowler.
That was Billy Wailu. Billy Wailu. You know, I remember all those names, Buddy Bomar. And I'm going to tell you something. You're not going to believe me. But okay. I kid a little. I never lie. I actually remember the number of the bowling ball I always liked to use at the old Rollaway Bowling Alley on Pulaski Avenue. It was number 512. Yeah, that was my ball. Because it was
you
lighter.
Play in a league? I know you did softball, Bob. But did you play in the bowling league ever?
No, I wasn't that good. My dad did, but I didn't. But I liked to bowl like everybody else back in the day. And where is that ball now? I have to look for that.
Someone find it for Bob.
Maybe I'd be good again at bowling if I could find it.
It's the ball, really, isn't it? But it's kind of funny how they were trying to introduce people to the sport. Like, here's how you do it. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Good afternoon, my friends. Welcome to Bill Swirsky Superfans. I'm Bill Swirsky, and with me, as always, are the super fans, Pat Arnold.
Hey, Bill.
Todd O'Connor.
Bill.
And Carl Walarski.
How you doing, Bill?
As you're, I'm sure, aware, the Bears are getting ready for their big playoff against the New York Giants. The Bears are 7-point underdogs, but don't count them out. Now let's go around the room for some predictions.
Pat, the Bears, 62-3.
Todd, Bears, 79-0.
Oh, really? You don't think that the Giants will score?
No, I do not. The Bears' defense is like a wall. You can't go through them.
All right. How about you, Carl?
I say Bears 52-14.
Oh, what? Come on.
I'm sorry.
All right, leave him alone. That's his prerogative. As for my prediction, at game's end, there will be two teams of contrasting moods heading off the field, my friends. One glum, one gleeful. The gleeful of which being... The Bears.
That started it all, didn't it? January 12th, 1991.
Yeah, I mean, Bob Schmeichel's creation debuting this week on SNL, Bob, there, right before the Bears-Giants playoff game. That's thus the predictions you heard right there. Chicago native Joe Mantegna was hosting SNL that night. Bob Schmeichel had spent a lot of time in Chicago on the comedy circuit and just, you know, fell in love with Chicago sports fans. And he convinced Joe and Bob Odenkirk, Chicago area guy, was one of the head writers, of course, at SNL. Let's try out these characters. I think this would be really funny. And Odenkirk at the time thought that they were too regional and no one really outside of Chicago would get it. But he was happy to be proven wrong because the audiences loved it. It survived and became a regular bit. The Bears super fans. Schmeichel said he got the idea after moving to Chicago and hanging out at Cubs games, actually. He said he noticed a large number of insanely confident Chicago sports fans, borderline delusional, he called them, wearing aviator sunglasses and sporting these big walrus mustaches. And he said, you know, there's something going on here. Plus this like hero worship of Ditka and the whole bit. So he put it together. 30 years after they debut, the Bears superfan made a prominent appearance on the pregame show for the Super Bowl. Bears weren't in it, of course, but they were celebrating 100-year anniversary of the NFL. And here we pulled the bit from the NBC Sports promo with the superfans.
I thought I smelled some aged cheese. Have a seat. Join us.
And let's talk about this rivalry, can we?
Well, the Bears were the NFL's signature team for years.
The Packers won 5 championships in 7 years and 2 Super Bowls.
Very sad. That is fake news, fake my news. Friend.
Well, that's what happened.
Yeah, well, let's ask the computer about that.
Yeah, good idea.
Mary Pat, why don't you tell us who won the NFL title in the 60s?
In the 1960s, the Bears prevailed, winning the first 2 Super Bowls and hoisting up the Ditka Trophy.
I was 22-10 against the Bears.
Not accurate.
No. Mary Pat?
Mary Pat.
Brett Favre's record was -1-33 versus the Bears.
The Bears.
That's Brett Favre in there.
Yeah, he stepped up. He dared to talk to the superfans. I love how the Siri is Mary Pat. Mary Pat. It's a perfect Chicago thing.
This is interesting. A ski resort in the city limits of Chicago. Tell us about this history.
Yeah. Could have survived a long time, Bob, but didn't. And here's the story. The Chicago's got its first ski resort within city limits, 1968. It's the site of where the Brickyard Mall is today. It was an abandoned brick factory the Carey family owned and decided to repurpose it as a ski resort. They had huge dreams attached to this project. They were going to turn the old factory into a chalet, build a hotel on site, a number of restaurants, make it a huge destination in Chicago. The Chicago Tribune announced its opening saying, at 285 feet, Thunder Mountain boasts the tallest vertical drop of any ski resort for 200 miles. And a lot of hype around thinking who was going to come and what a big deal it was going to be. Problem was, Bob, they chose to open it in 1968. Instead of 1967, which would have made a huge difference because we had record snowfall and, of course, a legendary blizzard in 67. But in 68, there was like no snow. And that's that did it in. The ski resort didn't make it past one season, laid vacant for many years, and then they developed it into the Brickyard Mall. But there you go.
Yeah,
could have been.
Never knew the history of the Brickyard area there. But that's interesting. They weren't figuring, well, we're going to have to make the snow with machines. We're not going to get enough snow every year. You would have think that they would have thought about that.
Well, you think the year after this legendary snowfall, they're like, of course we'll have snow.
Yeah. Well,
and, you know, I just didn't work out that way, sadly for them.
Finally, we have some pizza history to talk about here.
Oh, I always love the pizza history. Home run in pizza. Do you ever buy the frozen ones at the grocery store?
It's definitely one of the best of the frozen variety, isn't it?
If you
have the real deal, it's excellent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, always better. But they are out there mass distributed all across the country today. Home run in pizza started, of course, on the South Side, Bob. 1952 is when they started distributing them outside their tiny tavern restaurant that they had built. Mary and Vincent Grattan had the idea of serving small squares of homemade pizza to customers who were drinking at the bar. Instead of pretzels or nuts, they were like, yeah, let's do pizza. We're Italian. We got a good recipe. And they came up with this pizza. Soon after that, everyone wanted the pizza. They turned it into a restaurant. And the story, just how they got the home run in name, is a kid's baseball at a nearby park came through the window one day, and the owner yelled, home run! And then they changed the name of the restaurant to Home Run Inn. But just pretty incredible how they figured out this whole distribution, the frozen pizza thing, way in the early in the 50s. They were ahead of the game on that, and so they still are family-owned and still operate. I have 750 employees in Woodridge and make over 100,000 frozen pizzas every day so that people across the country who can't make it to one of the number of home run-in locations can enjoy it.
Good thing a kid didn't drop the ball, and then they would have had to name it Error Pizza, and not
right.
A good marketing
thing. Things would have been very different then for marketing purposes, but...
Thanks for making me want pizza for breakfast now.
I know.
Anna. We'll
hungry
talk
now?
To you next Wednesday.
Bye, Bob.